Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Inyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Perhaps we could begin with tonight's meeting, the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship.
Tonight we're showing a video called Darwin's Dilemma, and then we'll break out in sessions to talk about it. And we'll also have a trilobite collection there tonight from one of our members.
Alan Radke is bringing his extraordinary collection of trilobites from around the world, and this video is put out by Illustra Media. They're the folks who made a couple other great videos.
Yeah, Unlocking the Mystery of Life and Privileged Planet, which actually was shown on PBS, surprisingly.
And Fred, these videos have brought so many scientists to come out of the closet and say, hey, evolution and the Big Bang, it just doesn't explain what we see. Well, their third video in the series is called Darwin's Dilemma, and the fact that there's a public showing tonight is so exciting. And this is at Wadsworth and 21st, right?
Yeah, 21st and Wadsworth. It's Bethlehem Lutheran Church in the chapel.
Okay, and so it's easy to find, 7 o'clock. And this is about the Cambrian explosion. And evolutionists have had to deal with this for a long time now. They've known that there is this explosion of life at this level. Like before it, there's virtually no life. Then all of a sudden, there's this wild presence of fossil evidence of life around the world. Suddenly, well, now they could take that to a higher level because of all the advances in microbiology. When they look at the biological systems on these creatures, they now realize how wildly sophisticated they are.
Yeah, they're incredibly complex. And so this idea of going from simple to complex in the fossil record was totally overturned on its head by the Cambrian explosion.
Yeah.
You know, you find all these major body plans all appearing suddenly in the fossil record. Mm-hmm. Now, does that sound like an evolutionary perspective or a creation perspective?
Creationist perspective, that life was created by God, did not evolve gradually over a billion years. And so the sudden occurrence in the fossil record of wildly complex life, and you'll see it in the video tonight. Fred, this is so fun because now they've also found, we covered this on a recent Real Science Friday show, a cell a billion years older than they thought that life had evolved. And so that gives them a dilemma that there's a billion years of missing fossil evidence.
Yeah, and wasn't that cell remarkably similar to version of today's?
It's always that way, right? We found these shrimp. Look at this. Fossil shrimp. It's 3 inches. Oh, it's a jumbo shrimp. And it, wow, it looks just like a modern
amazingly
shrimp.
Similar to a modern-day shrimp.
Yeah, Fra Diavolo. So, Fred, so that's going to be fun tonight. And so member of Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship, Alan Radke, will also be there with his trilobite collection. And, I mean, his largest trilobite is huge. And the preservation, the fine preservation is just startling. And so bring your kids, bring your family. You'll be able to see a fabulous documentary video by Illustra Media, the same guys who brought us Unlocking the Mysteries of Life and the Privileged Planet. We sell these here at Bob Inyart Live. We sell them. In fact, you'll be able to buy one tonight after the presentation. And then they'll break up in small groups and talk through what they had just seen.
That's right. So, should be real exciting.
Yeah, real fun. Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. And what's their website if somebody wants more info?
It's youngearth.org.
That's cool, too.
Real easy to remember. Youngearth.org.
Okay. Fred, you and I had lunch today with a Denver businessman, and he's all excited about creation and the debate with evolution, and he loves it. And he told us about a recent news story, how the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, they are doing this dig, a fossil dig in snowmass, and lo and behold, they're finding interesting things like a mastodon skull, which is, they're describing it as huge. They're working to encase a 7-foot tusk in a plaster cast so it could be removed from the mud. They're finding really neat things up in snowmass. And in Colorado, there's all kinds of fossils that show us evidence of life in the past.
That's right. Like Dinosaur National Monument. I mean, what an incredible array of fossils we have there. Of not just dinosaurs, even though it's called Dinosaur National Monument.
That's right. Well, can we talk about that for a moment? Because, you know, the snowmass find interested me, partly because, Fred, the election is now over. My family worked for about a year and a half, including our three young boys. And my brother and his wife, Brian and Jennifer, they gave us as a gift a week in the Colorado Rockies at a resort. We're just so thrilled. So we'll be going skiing pretty soon. We're going to have a great time. So this snowmass find, maybe we could stop off and look at the dig and see what's going on. They found evidence of a number of mammoths that they're digging up, a mastodon tooth, and they're really having a good time there. But at Dinosaur National Monument, that place is known around the world for the extraordinary and well-preserved dinosaur fossils, including an allosaur skull, which friends of this show dug up an allosaur skull just outside of the park boundary on a private ranch. And Fred, that skull is now, and this is a homeschool family, they dug up the world's largest allosaur skull, and it's about 98% complete.
Wow.
It's one of the most complete. I think it has all its teeth. And inside its mouth, there was a piece of wood. And the wood, as it was buried, you know, its mouth was shoved open and dirt was in its mouth and a chunk of wood. And that wood is half fossilized and half not. Half carbon, biological carbon, and half rock. And that's in the mouth of an allosaur.
Wow, do they still have that fossil?
Oh, they sure do.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary find. It's worth a lot of money.
Well, you know, one of our members has gone to Dinosaur National Monument quite a bit over the years.
One of the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship members?
Yes, Bill Browning. And it's interesting, over time, the stories he's gotten from the park rangers.
The stories are changing, like they're changing at Yellowstone and all around the world.
Just like the age of the earth seems to change every 15, 20 years.
Yeah, Carlsbad Caverns, the stories are changing. So how have they changed there at Dinosaur National Monument?
When he first went there, the story was your typical, well, these dinosaurs died, and then over millions of years, sediment rocks buried them.
They
and
were
left
gradually
fossils.
Buried, which never made any sense
never
for
made
any fossils.
Sense at all. And they find a ton of them. If you've seen it, Bob,
it's like a graveyard.
It's a graveyard of dinosaur bones. It's
right.
Huge.
Right. And Fred, when they say a dinosaur would die, not only a dinosaur, a saber-toothed tiger, any animal would die, and it would gradually get buried with sediments. Well, that makes no sense because they decay. Animals eat them. Wind erosion, rain, ice, and microorganisms, and they're gone.
They're gone. That's right.
Animals don't fossilize when they die.
And so scientists realized over time, you know, how silly an argument that was. And so the next time Bill went, and I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember exactly how Bill described
it. And he was paraphrasing, too.
Yeah. So, you know, and the next time, he got a different story. And this time, it was that the dinosaurs died near a river. And so, as if that's going to somehow...
The riverbank explanation of the fossilization of 100 dinosaurs.
As if that's going to help the situation.
Right. That's just as bizarre. I mean, animals die by rivers all the time. They don't fossilize. So, you got big dinosaurs, they die by the edge of a river and they turn into a fossil graveyard? No.
Well, yeah, it's amazing how they come up with these ideas. It kind of reminds me of the dinosaur extinction theories and about how one of the theories was that they committed suicide. And I'm not kidding. That was one of the theories that was proposed one time. I don't know if they found a bunch of fossils at the bottom of a cliff or...
right. When, you know, whale beachings became popular. And so then, of course, they don't know that most dinosaurs were killed in a global flood. They don't believe in a global flood on Earth, only on Mars, where there's no liquid water.
Yeah, there's no water on Mars, and far less evidence for a global flood. But yet a global flood occurred on Mars, according to the scientists.
Right, and on Earth, we're two-thirds covered in water, a mile deep, and they don't believe it's possible to have a global flood on Earth.
And we find marine life on all the major mountain ranges.
Right.
You could go on and on.
And mixed in with all the dinosaurs. Maybe not all of them. But,
yeah.
Okay,
but
So they said, okay, the dinosaur fossils, they were by a river, the edge of a riverbank. And that just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it was silly. So the last time, and I was out there with Bill Browning and a group of us from Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. And interestingly, this time the park ranger said that the dinosaur fossils were buried there by some kind of local water catastrophe.
Okay, a water catastrophe.
So they're getting better.
They're getting closer. Right?
They're getting warmer.
Right. And you better get there soon, otherwise it's going to be real warm. Forget about global warming. It's going to be the lake of fire. So, yeah, they are getting warmer. They're getting closer. So it wasn't dinosaurs wandering through the forest, die, lay down, gradually covered with sediment. That doesn't work. It's not dinosaurs and millions of other animals walking along the banks of rivers, dying and being fossilized. It's some kind of a water catastrophe. But this is funny because they called it a local water catastrophe. So, Fred, the next step is they have to start to admit that these things are regional and continental.
Yeah, get them to the continental level, then we'll be really close to global level.
Right, then you're getting warmer.
Continental evidence is overwhelming.
It's overwhelming, but can we say something about, you said, when I said they find dinosaur fossils at Dinosaur National Monument, you said that's not all they find.
It isn't.
Well,
so I kind of gave a clue a little bit earlier in the radio show about how we find marine life on all the major mountain ranges.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do they find at Dinosaur National Monument? In fact, they find more of these than they do dinosaurs.
I can't guess because I'm clamming up.
You're clamming up. Okay, huh.
they find clams. In fact, they find a lot more clams than they do dinosaurs. And so, Fred, if this is a watery catastrophe and the place is loaded with clams and they got different kinds of clams, some of the clams are disarticulate.
That means they can't speak very well.
Yeah. Right. Like me. But, and some of the clams are full clams, but many of them are all broken up. They were transported there in a water catastrophe, but it's not a continental catastrophe. This was a part of a global flood. And that's why, like you said, every major mountain range, except for, say, volcanoes, right? But every one of the world's major mountain ranges have sea fossils, seashells, on the summits of the mountains.
That's right. In fact, if you went to a Home Depot and went through their gravel, you have a pretty good chance finding marine life.
Wow.
I could make a wager and then win that bet saying we can go to Home Depot and go through the gravel. You find marine life buried everywhere, and you made an interesting point about the disarticulation. If you look at the other side of that coin, the fact that we find a lot of these clams buried in a closed position. So why is that important?
Because when a clam dies...
Let me just talk about the very first time we went on a beach as a family, because I know a lot of people relate to this, and you want to pick up all these shells. It's really cool, and you go back to your hotel room. Well, we noticed that it was starting to stink.
Fred, I'm interrupting your story. You went on vacation to the sea?
Vacation to the sea.
And we are going skiing with our kids on the beach, downhill skiing.
Wow.
Now, that would make no sense, right? You don't go skiing on the beach because you don't have the beach and the ocean with ski slopes. Well, you don't have clams with dinosaurs all being buried in a big pile.
That's right.
You don't have it. It would be as stupid as Fred saying we went to the beach to take our kids downhill skiing. You don't do it. And so the evolutionary worldview is filled with contradictions.
Yeah.
Just filled. But I'm sorry, you went to the beach.
Yeah. And so the point here is these things started to stink. They smelled, you know, kind of fishy smell. Well, it turns out clams that are closed, they're not dead. They're still alive.
Right.
So they were kind of rotting in our kitchen sink.
Right.
So why would we find a lot of clams buried in the fossil record in the closed position? What does that indicate?
That means they were buried instantly, and they weren't able to open. When they die, they open.
When they die, they open, so they were buried alive. So it would have to be some kind of rapid, catastrophic event.
Right. And we have both kinds of clams at Dinosaur National Monument, which is in Colorado, right near Utah, right near the border in northwestern Colorado. By the way, Fred, I mentioned our friends who dug up that Allosaur skull. We brought some of our boys. We were helping them excavate another dinosaur. They had already completed the Allosaur, and you could go to KGOV, KGOV.com, just search with our KGOV search for Allosaur, raising the Allosaur, which is a dinosaur. You'll find out all about it. It's just tremendous. And that's a homeschool family. And Fred, they did a great job. But then in the lab, the preservation of it, just so professional.
Did they find any brontosaurs or?
Allosaurs and conosaurs. Found a conosaur and an allosaur. That's a good one. Next time Pops gets upset, I'm going to say allosaur. Allosaur again. Okay, so Fred, we find at Dinosaur National Monument in Colorado, we find the skeletons of many dinosaurs. I've been there a number of times. It's a great place to go. Bring your kids. And what they tell you, it changes dramatically over a short period of time because they're making it up. They're making it up. Mm-hmm. They were buried as part of a watery catastrophe that buried land animals and clams, seashells, buried them because this was a global flood, but they're not there yet. They have to say local.
They don't want to give the Bible any kind of...
I mean, what is credit? Their evidence that it was local? We got all these dinosaur skeletons and these clams, and it was local because there was a clam shack, seafood house, where the dinosaurs hung out, and we know it was local. It's loco, that's what it is.
That is loco. You know what else you find there, or close to there, and I can't remember how many of these are in the park itself, are these pictographs drawn on the side of mountains from the Indians of these dinosaurs with other people.
Wow. Now, there are drawings, indications of dinosaurs, dragons that look awfully like dinosaurs from around the world in all different cultures. Some of them, I think it was the Incas that had pretty much anatomically correct depictions of a stegosaur from way back, and so that's all interesting.
Yeah, and they're burial stones, right, that they found in tombs.
Yeah, so the Bible says that God destroyed mankind and all the land-dwelling creatures in a global flood, and this is back in the last 5,000 years because of the rebellion of mankind, and he saved 8 people on the ark and the animals that were on the ark, and from them came all the life we have today, including human life, and there's a lot of genetic evidence that the story is true. Mitochondrial Eve lived 6,000 years ago, and there was a genetic bottleneck of men and women as God describes the people who were on the ark. It's a lot of fun, Fred, to read all this.
Were dinosaurs on the ark, Bob?
There were dinosaurs on the ark, and not full-grown dinosaurs. They didn't have brontosaurs because they didn't exist, right? The evolutionists put different dinosaurs together, invented a brontosaur. But they would bring what? Adult dinosaurs?
Well, no, you don't need to bring the senior citizens on board.
No offense
to y'all out there.
You bring baby dinosaurs.
Yeah, or even teenage dinosaurs. Of course, they may have been hard to manage. The cell phone usage would have gone out the roof.
But. Yeah, right. Yeah. So anyway, it's so fun to study the Bible and see that the history of mankind and the very geology of the earth affirms the story in the Bible. Because when Moses wrote that all the high mountains were covered by this flood, Fred, what did he do? Run out to every continent and bury seashells everywhere just to try to prove he was right?
Boy, that'd be quite a feat.
Yeah, it would be. So that's not what happened. But how about this? You said there's evidence that this event is not local. The continental evidence should be obvious to the geologist and the atheist, the evolutionist.
Well, yeah, you got these sedimentary layers. For example, in North America, there's a place called the Columbian Plateau.
Yeah.
This is, I don't know,
in the Pacific Northwest.
In the Pacific Northwest. So we're talking hundreds of miles wide. And I know it's miles thick. You can look it up on the internet. It's a huge area of sedimentary deposits.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean? It's a bunch of mud that got that's left there from the flood.
And we have, in fact, places on continents all over the world where you have thousands of square miles of continuous sedimentary layers. Some are thinner, some are thick, some are thousands of feet thick. And the boundaries between the two of them, you see there's no scraping. The one was laid down on top of the other. And yet, because of the way they find fossils in some of these layers, they say, well, this layer on top is older than the layer on the bottom, even though it's hundreds of square miles, and no evidence that the one slid over the other, none, except their evolutionary framework would be dealt a death blow if they admitted that the layer on top was younger than the layer on the bottom, which they couldn't admit.
Yeah, so how do they deal with this problem we just talked about with the dinosaurs and the clams buried together?
Clam up. When you go there, Fred, when you go there, they don't make a big deal of clams.
Well, I'm clamoring for an answer.
All right. If we get one more pun, this is too punny. All right. So, Fred, maybe we should change the topic.
Okay.
Colorado, maybe our kids and I will go to the Snowmass fossil dig to see what's going on out there. I mean, it's really fun. Remains of several prehistoric animals have been discovered. And Fred, every time this happens, it helps the creationists. Like when they found in a quarry a school of jellyfish in layers that they said these layers were laid down over a million years. So each one would be thousands to 100,000 years old. And lo and behold, they find jellyfish, which are very hard to fossilize. They have no hard body parts. Jellyfish, a school of jellyfish, fossilized across all the layers. That cracks me up, Fred. What, do the jellyfish have a reunion there every 80,000 years? They say, let's come back here where our ancestors were fossilized and see what's going on. And lo and behold, more of them got caught in the rocks.
Yeah, it'd be like going to the petrified forest in Yellowstone Park and getting buried there. And then the next 10,000 years, your ancestors come. And...
yeah, right. This is where Bob and his family were fossilized. Ah! It's just so silly. Okay, so could we talk about the latest edition of Answers Magazine? Who puts out Answers Magazine?
And that would be Answers in Genesis.
Yeah, Ken Ham. And what a team they have at the Creation Museum and Answers in Genesis online on the internet. What a great resource. And they have an article about gibbons that, Fred, I don't know if you saw that article. I just loved it. And I'd love to talk through it. Did you read the article?
I did read that article. It's a gibbon is a type of ape.
A type of ape. There's four different kinds of apes, right?
There's a gorilla, orangutan, chimpanzee.
And gibbons.
There you go. And gibbons?
Yeah. No, not and gibbons. And gibbons. And so, Fred, these monkeys, they stand about 2 feet tall. They weigh about 15 pounds. They're extraordinary. God made them so that they could live in treetops.
They live really high up in the
really high up
trees.
Like in Southeast Asia rainforests. These trees, they are 75 to 200 feet above the ground. That's where they live and play. And so for a human being like an acrobat, if he fell from 30 feet high and fell, he'd be dead maybe, like from the top of a telephone pole.
Oh yeah.
But God has made these creatures that they're so flexible and so powerful that, for one, they don't fall often, but they live in treetops, so they do fall sometimes. And they have very thick, dense bones, much stronger than ours. So that does help them when they fall.
And yeah, and their feet are like hands. So they really got four hands and no feet.
Four hands.
And so when they fall, they have a lot of things they can, they got four things to grab with.
Right.
Imagine us falling. We're trying to grab with our hands and
our
arms. We're not trying to grab with our feet.
We can't grab onto a branch with our toes as we're falling. These things can. And guess how fast, well, you know, you read the article. Guess how fast, I'll ask the audience, guess how fast these gibbons can swing through trees? They've been clocked.
35 miles an hour.
No, that just can't be. I mean, my kids on bicycles, I don't know if they go 35 miles an hour, the young ones. That's fast. These monkeys, these gibbons, they swing 35 miles an hour, faster than a squirrel jumping from one branch to another branch, faster, because if you've ever been on monkey bars and you swing from one to the other, well, God didn't make us to live on treetops. He made gibbons to live on treetops. So we're different. Well, gibbons, their joints in their hands and their shoulders, a baby gibbon could hang from a branch for a half hour, just hang and rest. An adult for an hour. They could rotate their bodies 360 degrees while hanging from one hand. From one arm on a branch. So you're hanging there for an hour. You might want to see what's going on behind you. So the gibbon just turns around, and all he does, he turns around. And what would happen to a human being, Fred, if we did that? Our arm would break off. It would twist off and break off.
Well, yeah. It's,
and our blood vessels would pop. God gave them special blood vessels. He did the most amazing things. And when, because of the way their skeleton is made and their joints, they're able to swing from branch to branch where the bulk of their body weight is pulling them forward at each moment.
That's right. And the use of that body weight allows them to travel up to 50 feet between branches. Can you imagine trying to...
Well, when I was on a monkey bars when I was a kid, we might, you know,
maybe
swing and go
2 feet or
2 feet, 3 feet, maybe 50 feet between branches. It's astounding.
At 35 miles an hour.
It's astounding how God made them, but God didn't make us to live in trees, but to walk on the ground. Gibbon, when a gibbon walks on the ground, they have to hold their arms over their head. Because otherwise they lose their balance.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad I don't have to hold my arms over my head, Fred.
Well, I am too, Bob, but it'd be kind of cool to swing from, you know, between 50 feet.
But they're always
trade-offs. But I'm afraid of heights, though, yeah. So then, you know.
But there are always trade-offs, right?
There's trade-offs.
So tonight, 7 o'clock, Alan Radke's Trilobite Collection and Darwin's Dilemma. What a great video. God bless you guys.